morning to all of you. We expected a large crowd, and we are prepared if you want to, and if the press at the door should demand it, we are prepared to move into the quadrangle. It's a nice day out there. However, I think it would be a much more intimate gathering, and the questions will flow more naturally if we can remain in here. There are places on the floor for those who don't mind sitting on a carpet or being on the carpet in front of the president or sitting at his or sitting at his feet or whatever. Feel free to crowd in here, and if we can make it go here, let us do that. It's a distinct privilege for us at Concordia Seminary to have with us this morning the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. J.A. O. Preuss. He has been a friend of this institution for many years, including those years when he was best known as the man who appointed a fact-finding committee to find out what was going on here. The institution, as represented by its faculty last spring, awarded him its highest honorary degree when it bestowed upon him the degree Doctor of Divinity and recognized in its citation that President Preuss has indeed been a very instrumental figure in the history of Lutheranism and especially in the history of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And we paid tribute to his strong stand for confessional Lutheranism, but also recognized that in this president, the Missouri Synod has been blessed with a theologian, a scholar, whose productivity as scholar has not ceased during his tenure in office. I will always remember my friend Jack, as I have called him for many, many years, as a man who has stood up better under the most vitriolic abuse imaginable than I could ever imagine anyone else doing. I don't know of another figure in recent church history who has been subjected to the kind of innuendo, half-truth, name-calling, and misrepresentation that this man has endured. And I, for one, feel that this is one of his strongest assets, that he has handled all of this without getting too greatly agitated. He's been called many things. I don't want to. In fact, I could spend the next 10 minutes reading the list. But I won't do that. I did think it was a bit unkind, though, last week when he made this shocking announcement to the Missouri Synod and really to the whole religious world that he has chosen not to stand for re-election as president of our church body in its convention next summer. A time like that, you expect the press to say nice things about you, and by and large, they have done that. You notice, however, in the local paper, what I thought might have been the unkindest cut of all, and a man who has taken so much, was the sentence that went something like this: President J.A. O. Preuss, a stocky Norwegian, you know, has been president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod since 1969. Now, why should a man endure that? I mean, Jack, after all, why should they question whether or not you're Norwegian? That is surely well known. No, really, chit-chat and banter aside, it's a great privilege and an honor to have you here, President Preuss, and we're looking forward to your comments and your suggestions to all of us. President Preuss.
Thank you. I'm not sure how to take that reception. The last time I got one like that was at the Charismatic Convention in Minneapolis. You know, this Norwegian stuff gets to hang out. Professor Herber back there was, who has some charismatic tendencies anyway, told me recently that he'd had a vision. And the Lord had appeared to him in a dream and said, I will answer three questions for you, any three questions you have. And so Herber, in his analytical, incisive way, said, do you think that the Missouri Synod will ever ordain women? And the Lord said, not in my lifetime. I'm sorry, I missed the cue. Not in Preuss's lifetime. And then he said, do you think that the Lutherans will ever, in the United States, will ever be united into one church? And the Lord said, not in Preuss's lifetime. And then he said, do you think the Synod will ever elect another Norwegian? And the Lord said, not in my lifetime. Sorry, I missed that one. Dr. Bowman always talks about all of my sufferings and all of this sort of thing. I wanted to know that I was very well trained for this position and came into the presidency with a very thick hide. In my first call, way back about the turn of the century, I succeeded a man who had been fired. And it was a very small and somewhat run-down congregation. They'd fired him mostly to preserve the remnant that was left. And he'd cleaned out of there, and it was right at the end of the Depression. And I came into this parsonage, which had been built. It was an eight-room parsonage, and they'd built it for $4,500. So you get an idea of what it was like. And there wasn't a stick. There was nothing in that house. And I walked up to the study. There was absolutely nothing there. There wasn't even an old copy of the Brief Statement or of Luther's Catechism sitting around. All there were three envelopes sitting on the bookshelf. And on top was a note, in case of trouble, open these in numerical order. Well, I hadn't been at it more than about 6 months, and I ran into hot water with the Board of Elders. And so I finally, in desperation one night, opened the first envelope, and it simply said, blame your predecessor, which I duly did. And about 6 months later, I got into hot water with the Ladies' Aid. And so finally, I opened the second envelope, and the words were there, blame your predecessor. And about 6 months after that, I got into hot water with the Voters' Assembly. And so finally, I opened the third envelope, and it simply had the words, prepare three envelopes. So I came into this job with some experience. It's a great pleasure to be here. And I'm delighted to see the fine attendance you're having here this year. Certainly want to welcome the new students and the returning vicars and all of you to back to the grindstone. I don't think there's much question that there'll be a job for you when you finish, because we still have about 500 vacancies. Although the gap between the number of vacancies and the number of candidates is closing, the Synod really operates best with about 400 vacancies. In that way, we're able to move these fellows, and there's some mobility. If you have every congregation filled, you can't move them. And there's an old adage that says that if he's a good one, no congregation should have a monopoly on him for life, and if he's not so hot, no congregation should be stuck with him forever. So it's in the interests of all concerned, both the men and the congregations, that there be a significant number of vacant parishes. The problem we always have is defining a parish. A parish probably is best defined as a congregation of any size which owns a parsonage. And if you get one out in the sand hills of Nebraska or someplace that has continually declined since the year 1900, but if that old 12-room parsonage is still out there, they still expect to have a full-time preacher. And I don't know what can be done about it, but that is one of the things that, on the one hand, keeps the list of vacancies high, and on the other hand, at least serves as a way, as a training ground for candidates just coming out into the ministry. Now, Mrs. Silflo had, no, I'm not calling you, I'm just using your name, had suggested that I sort of talk to you on synodical matters and then you can fire away on anything you want to. I just might say that trying to categorize some of these areas, my main effort right at the moment is the biennial one of preparing for another convention. I don't know that any of you will be delegates to the convention next summer, but on the outside chance that there might be one or two of them in the crowd, I would urge you to vote for the change to a triennial or a quadrennial quadrennial or triennial system, rather than having these conventions every 2 years, and likewise district conventions every 2 years. It costs the Senate about $1 million to hold a convention, and it costs the 38 districts another $1 million to hold those conventions. And unless you are in a period of great stress and turmoil and difficulty, there really isn't enough business to occupy the attention of the number of people that are involved in these conventions, take them away from their parishes and their work, and spend all of that money that it costs. So I hope that the convention, but as I say, my time now is spent largely in preparing for the 1981 Convention of Synod. The issues that will probably be of the greatest interest before the convention will, of course, be the election. People love politics. I talked to a man last night who had said that it was about a preaching date, and he said, "I noticed that you are retiring from the job." Well, I said, when you look at the national scene, you wish that some of these guys would retire even before they were elected. Somewhat that'll be the case with the synodical election. You're going to see candidates launched, and it's going to be like trap shooting. The name will be shot out, and there'll be more target practice in the next 9 months than we've had for years. The election process that was created after the fiasco at Denver is not entirely bad, in that it gives to the poor guy that is nominated or proposed or touted by somebody at least a chance to think a little bit about it before he's elected. Also gives him a chance to say that he's not interested. The other side of the coin is that it produces an open politicking method rather than the sort of pious, covert type of politicking that always existed, in which smoke-filled rooms were filled with smoke and people were holding meetings, all of which were classified as clandestine, and nobody could do any thinking about it until he was elected. Now, at least when five good men and true are nominated for that position, they, number one, have said, a significant number of congregations have said, we think he's worthy of consideration. And that's done by congregations and not just by cliques or guys that fill smoke-filled rooms. Secondly, it gives the man a chance to say, yes, I'm willing to stand as a candidate, or I am unwilling to do so. So then he begins to think, a quality that at least some members of the human race have, and he can begin to think about things that he'd like to do, appointments that he'd like to make, the general direction that the Synod ought to take, and not just be suddenly thrust into it like a 3-month-old baby who is dumped into a swimming pool and discovers whether or not he was descended from a fish by whether or not he can stay afloat. It was very difficult for me in 1969, and something I wouldn't wish on anybody. The bad side about the thing is that although it produces open politicking and everybody can get into the act, it is bound to produce a certain amount of acrimony, a certain amount of hurt feelings, and because a lot of the people that do the electioneering are totally irresponsible. I think it's quite significant. And I think if I were to ask you, any one or all of you, to name the 3 most potent political journals in the Missouri Synod, you would all name Christian News, Missourian Perspective, and Lutheran Forum. And I think it's so amusing that all 3 are published, edited, and the sole responsibility of a fella at New Haven who has never been certified, 2 fellas here in St. Louis, one of whom graduated from Seminex and has never been certified, the other of whom was dropped from the clergy roster of Synod, and in the case of Lutheran Forum, a fellow who not only has dual membership, but is only visible service to the church is conducted in an LCA congregation. Now, these are the fellows that stand around on the edge of things and indulge in the largest amount of the trap shooting. So it's an amusing thing in a way. And then, of course, they always get lots of help from the Lacusa News Bureau and sometimes the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. So the whole thing is... It will have some injuries and some hurts will be connected with it, no matter how gentlemanly the candidates may be. It's my personal opinion, and this is obviously I had no other choice in making this announcement but to do it now, because there was no way to go through a nominating process and let a whole bunch of congregations throw their nominations away on a person who wasn't going to be a candidate. But I think the 9 months gestation period will have the value that finally, after all of the pish-posh and balderdash has been uttered, the common sense and good judgment of the rank-and-file people of the Missouri Synod will demonstrate itself, as it usually does, and we will get a president who will be representative of the Synod and who will be able to give the guidance and direction that any church body obviously needs. The second issue that will come before the convention of Synod that will, I think, be of, I wouldn't say it's controversial, but it's going to have a certain amount of discussion with it, is the report of the task force on, I never can remember the title of it, bylaws, constitution, structure, This task force, I'm going to propose to the convention that this task force be made a standing committee, like the mission board or the Committee for Constitutional Matters, because we've had these task forces in being now for 25 years. There's been somebody always trying to figure out how to turn a 1847 one-hoss shay into a 1950, then 1960, then 1970, and 1980 or 90 organization that can function efficiently and effectively. I think they're coming with some pretty good ideas. Be glad to expand on them if any of you are interested. I mentioned the one, namely the triennial cycle. That's the word I was fishing for. Triennial cycle for conventions. They're trying to upgrade the role of the circuit in the life of the church. And they are attempting to streamline some of the boards and committees. I don't know that they're doing as much on that as I'd like to see them do, because all they're doing really is turning boards into task forces and juggling around with the method of the appointment of people to these boards, but the number of boards has not been materially reduced. But I'm completely pragmatic about this. This is a very good time to do certain of these things, because it costs us just like sin to haul in great big boards and enormous airfares and escalating hotel costs to do sometimes, in some cases, very, very little. Some of you will someday be appointed or elected to some of these boards, and while some of them do extremely important things, and obviously we couldn't function without them, some of them do much less than that, and the Synod could probably function quite well without them. My own feeling is that it would, rather than abolish a lot of them, I would cut down on the size. I don't think that wisdom necessarily is in proportion to the number of people in the room. Wisdom is in proportion to the kind of people that are in the room and the talents and the gifts that they have to give to the church. There are many, many facets to that. One of the underlying problems always in this thing is to lodge the ultimate responsibility. It's all well and good to say that the superpower in the Missouri Synod is the congregations, and that's true. Nobody argues it. But you can't conduct a poll of 6,000 congregations when you want to decide whether to send Jimmy Schmidt to India or Johnny Schwartz to New Guinea, and you only got enough money to send one of them. And that's a question that has to be settled by a mission board. So you elect representatives to do certain things for you, and they need to have certain authority so they can function and not have everything held up in an administrative limbo all the time. I think some things will be done, and we make progress slowly in this area. One thing that you need to understand, I don't think there's a course in it in the curriculum, but there really ought to be one, that you should be, in preparing for service in the Synod, you should all take a course in the movement and nature of glaciers. I think the Bible also says something about it when it talks about the infinite patience and mercy of God. The two are somewhat synonymous. Then the third item that will come before the convention, and that I think next to the presidency will probably be the hottest and most vigorously discussed is the question of the ALC fellowship. We had a meeting last week of our fellowship committee and of the CTCR. On the 6th of October, I'm addressing the American Lutheran Church in convention assembled, and we've been given certain assignments that are to be carried out and presented to the Synod, certain documents for study. The one has already been distributed, and some of you may have seen it, namely a study of the biblical teaching on fellowship and church relations, one that will be seeing the light of day in the very near future is the one that was requested by a floor committee at, I believe, the 79 convention, asking for a statement of the differences between our two churches. It was the thinking of our committee, of which Dr. Bowman is a member, and I might say that he has been a member of this, I think, since 1969, and I say without hesitation and without any attempt to flatter that I think Dr. Bowman is the outstanding church diplomatist or diplomat in the Missouri Synod. And I'm not saying that as a compliment to his suave, smooth PR he's had some rivals and even some betters in that department. But when it comes to dealing with other churches where on the one hand doctrine and principle are very important and cannot be yielded, and on the other hand, where tact, wisdom, good judgment, and the ability to keep doors open and keep the conversation going and so on, he is the man, I think, above any other in this Synod who has that talent, certainly much greater than I do. I'm a good door slammer. But thank the Lord we've got people like Ralph Bowman who can open them too. Matter of preparing this document on differences was not quite as simple as it sounds, because on the one hand we wanted to be eminently fair to the American Lutheran Church, and so we made it a point to share with them and are continuing to share with them the way we look at it. At one point in the conversation, they prepared a statement as to what they consider to be differences. I myself have always argued that I think that is probably the strongest piece of literature that's been produced in this area, because they point to some very crucial and deep-seated differences, but they do it in their way, in their language. Secondly, we do not want to, as I say, we want to be fair. Secondly, in a thing of this kind, you've got to be absolutely honest. You can't say too much, and you can't say too little. You can't be accused of cover-up, nor can you be accused of this broadside slam-bang type of thing in which some of our unofficial journals indulge in which, for example, if a pastor is divorced, and maybe I think it's for unscriptural reasons, that becomes a cause of separation between the Missouri Synod and the ALC. Now that reminds me of the story of the fellow who walked into a saloon one night in a little town and had a couple of beers, and he turned around and addressed the multitude, and he said, "I can lick any man in this tavern." And nobody paid any attention to him. And he had a couple more, and he turned around, he said, "I can lick any man in this town." Nobody gave him a nod. And finally, he had several more, and he really had his courage up, and he said, "I can lick any man in this county." at which point a little shriveled up guy came up and absolutely mopped the floor with him. And he was lying there on the floor, and he looked up and he said, "I guess I took in too much territory." Which he did. But in inter-Lutheran relations, it is much the cause of wisdom and judgment and prudence to take in less territory than you can, because if you take in too much territory, you always find yourself on the floor. And I've learned this in a long history. I have been involved in inter-Lutheran relations since I was about 27 years old, and I've seen all kinds of people function in this area, and this is one of them that my flesh crawls at some of the snide remarks and comments and articles, things of this kind that are produced in this area, which are totally counterproductive to anything. Thirdly, we have to be absolutely confessional. We as a church body do have a position, and the events of the last decade have revealed not only that a screwball president held to those principles, but a church body held to them. I deserve no credit for anything that happened in the Missouri Synod, nor do I deserve nearly the blame. The fact is that the Missouri Synod said loud and clear in every way it possibly could, we want to stand by our historic doctrinal position, our historic understanding of the Scripture and the Lutheran confessions, and we're willing to fight for it. We're willing even to die for it if it be necessary. Having said that, and having demonstrated it, we cannot go out and deal with other Lutheran church bodies in a manner that gives them or our own church or the people of the world the impression, oh, well, the Missouri Synod likes to fight among themselves, but when they get over here, they're a bunch of marshmallows. We can't do that. And therefore, this complicates our situation. And another factor in the thing is that we simply are living in two different worlds, the ALC and Missouri, in our overall attitude on diversity. I'm speaking to you as future pastors. And you're going to get this every pastoral conference you go to. I'm not saying this is necessarily right, but it is a part of the lifeblood of the Missouri Synod. And if you study church history, I spend my leisure hours translating Martin Chemnitz, whose whole life was summarized and epitomized and directed toward striving for unity of faith and unity of confession among Lutherans. Anything you read that he wrote deals with that subject in one way or another. First of all, stating the faith, and secondly, securing confessional allegiance to it, and thirdly, removing with tact and judgment and Bible study and the use of prayer and gentlemanly efforts, removing all possible differences among us in the area of confession. Very interesting, in all the stuff I've read of him, I've never seen one reference in his writings to liturgical matters. I don't think he cared whether the preacher wore a white gown or a black gown or his blue serge confirmation suit. But when it comes to what is pronounced from those pulpits and taught in those schools, it's very important that it be scriptural, that it be in keeping with the ancient creeds and the church fathers and the confessions of the Lutheran Church. And we of Missouri, and it can be a pain in the neck And it's going to be a pain in the neck to every one of you as it is to every one of us who's been out in this area. We strive, when it says in our Constitution, that we strive for uniformity. And that's a terrible word. That's not a 1980 word. That's an 1847 word. And I don't think it was very popular then. In such things as liturgical practice and the use of hymn books and tra-la, tra-la. Those words mean a great deal. And this is the whole structure of the whole Sitzim Leben, or the whole basic philosophy of the Missouri Synod. And so when we go to a meeting and we start talking about diversity, and one ALC man, a very nice, conservative, orthodox fella, turns to us and says, "Brethren, we agonize about these diversities in the ALC." That strikes a very sympathetic note in us. But when another man in the same meeting, in the same room, and about 3 minutes later says, "I totally disagree with you, brother. We rejoice in our diversities," and he's not talking about liturgy or hymn books or church architecture, he's talking about doctrine, this is very difficult for us of the committee to cope with. It's just contrary to everything we've ever lived for and lived with. And so, as I say, I think this is going to be a kind of a hot potato at the forthcoming convention. Now, to move into a few other areas of the synodical activity, I've really updated you on the inter-Lutheran situation. Forward and Remembrance campaign is going along very well. We're past the 5 million mark. We have exceeded all anticipated goals regarding the big gifts. We have the lovely and difficult problem that we've got more names of people to call on for big gifts, that means 25,000 or over, than we have collectors to go out and see them. And actually, if we would hit all those 800 people, and if they would give at the rate they have been giving, the whole $40 million could be raised through the big gift procedure without even going into phase two on the congregations. I am very optimistic about it, and I'm optimistic not just because of the money, although money is quite nice. It's the root of all evil, but it also does a few other things. But I am optimistic and happy about it because of the enormous degree of agreement and consensus and enthusiasm, and let's get going with it, and let's get on with the work of the Lord. This will be $15 million to give a shot in the arm to foreign missions, which in my opinion, I know Dr. Bowman won't agree with me, but I think that foreign missions is the most neglected aspect of the synodical program. Nobody speaks for them. If the seminary needs money, the president goes out and gets it. The Board of Control writes an article in a firm, and the money comes zapping in. Might even make the Lutheran Witness. if you want home missions, the Kansas District wants to start a new congregation at Topeka, the whole machinery of the Kansas District goes to work and says, "We're going to do it," and they do. But when you want to support or open new work in Korea or Nigeria or wherever it may be, there's nobody here to speak to show you how effective it is when they do. Years ago, the president of the India Evangelical Lutheran Church came over here. He was pretty articulate in English, and he came over into a meeting of the board of directors. He didn't quite take off his shoe and pound on the table with it, but he did just about everything else. And he said, "I got to have $70,000, and I'm not leaving this country till I get it." And the board of directors, hardly even in consultation with the mission board, and certainly not with anybody else, arranged some speaking tours for him and some some opportunities to meet people, and in a very short time he returned to India with that money. People will respond, but the story has to be told in a very ongoing and systematic way. But I'm very optimistic about it, and I hope that you, as pastors hitting the deck next spring, will give it all you've got in your congregations. It'll be a blessing for the congregations. I've been out on many of the big gift calls, and it's a kind of a marvelous thing to come to a person and propose that he give, say, $50,000 to maybe Concordia Seminary or maybe the work in Brazil or something. And when it's all done, the man says, thank you. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share the blessings I've had with the work of the Lord. I think that in most respects, and of course this had quite a bit to do with my decision not to be a candidate. It's like a preacher. You go through this same thing. You can get out into a congregation that you like very much. And I'll never forget my first congregation. Or no, my second one. Not the one with the envelopes. I succeeded an old fellow who had been there for 41 years. And he was a great fellow and very beloved, and he had done a lot of fine things. But he stayed too long. And by the time he left, about half of them were just plain sick and tired of him. And I had to laugh. One day I was out gassing with one of my honchos there, and he said, wouldn't it be marvelous if you could stay here for 41 years, just like your predecessor? I said, what would be so marvelous about it? So that your kids could fire me? There gets to be a point when you stay, you've overdone it. And I think that one of the reasons for my decision to step out of it now is that things are really going quite well. I think that's time to quit rather than wait till everybody is adding a rubric to the general prayer that the Lord will lead you. In general, I mean, the colleges are going. We've got some pretty good increase in most of them. No significant decrease in any of them. Synodical money is coming in increasingly better all the time. I think we're going to turn the corner this year on our debt operation and finally begin to operate in the black again after 4 or 5 years. And this is a kind of a miracle in the sense of when one considers what inflation does to you. The overseas churches are functioning about as well as they have in my mortal memory of it. A lot of enthusiasm. We went through a great deal of Sturm und Drang, as Dr. G and perhaps others can tell you here, with the whole shift over from these being mission churches dominated by American missionaries to the point of becoming partner churches under the direction of nationals, working largely with their own nationally educated clergy. And I think that in 10 years from now, when everybody looks back to this and all the dust is settled, people will say that this has been a very good era in the missiological aspect of the Missouri Synod. All churches that have gone through this, and all of them are, have encountered fumbles and stumbles on the part of nationals who one day were the body servant for some lordly missionary, and the next day they were president of a church and hardly didn't know what to do, but generally they've come through it very well. And I'm very pleased with the progress they're making. I say this not just because Dr. G is here, but I went in 1974 at the time when this whole thing was blowing up, And you recall that, some of you older folks recall that at the same time we had our problems here at the seminary, we were having problems all over the world with the partner churches or missions. And I took a round-the-world trip and I think visited something like 8 or 10 churches in about 12 days. And I want you to know that Montezuma had a very large relationship. He did not reside only in Mexico. He's got kissing cousins in Africa and India and a lot of places. And by the time I got to Korea, I was pretty near flat on my back. And it was so amusing because when we got there, Dr. Herbolz and I, we'd encountered some pretty good confrontations and some pretty angry people. And I guess he's your little brother. Is he younger than you? He always looked younger. I thought he was. Anyway, so we held a meeting, and I thought, well, now we get ready for another assault. But President G, he didn't talk about any of this. He says, I got a bunch of papers here and blueprints and plans and projections, and I want you to see them, and I want your approval on them. And it was all business and all progress, and the results are showing up every day in Korea, where nationals took it over, led it, gave it direction, and the thing is going marvelously well. And this is happening in many parts of the church. I think what happened down in Brazil, nobody planned it. Brazil is kind of a topsy. You know, if you would analyze the relationship of the Missouri Synod with these churches throughout the world that have grown up, there's almost a separate category for each. We never really had, certainly not in the year 1900, any kind of consolidated, unified mission policy. So, for example, those churches in South America that were started around 1900 and 1905 became districts of synod. I don't know if any other churches ever made them districts or whatever happened, but they were districts. And could send delegates. We could have even elected I always kidded down there that this President Gedrock, I said, I'm so delighted you're becoming a district, because if this joker stayed in the Missouri Synod, he'd have my job by the next election. An outstanding, charming, effective, bright fellow. Really good. And far better than his North American counterpart. And but we went from a handful down there in 1900. Seminary, I think, was started in 1903 with 6 students. And in a country, you know, that while Brazil has not been afflicted with revolutions, and it has not been afflicted with a Roman Catholic hierarchical government, it has been afflicted, like most Latin American countries, with poverty, with lack of organization, with changes in government quite often, and many, many problems that we North Americans, at least the U.S. people, are hardly acquainted with at all. But they've done amazing things, real progress. And it's a point of great pride with me to go down there to that convention in January of this year and sign some documents, you know, and preserving the pens for posterity and all this stuff, protocol documents, making this a partner church, ending the district affiliation, and in the same meeting, having a fella get up and hold up a great big book, and he said, this is the first copy of the Lutheran Confessions ever produced in the Portuguese language. The whole Book of Concord, in honor of the 400th anniversary. And to have them show you their mission plans. New projections all over the place. In 3 years, 3 years ago, they entered the country of Paraguay. Today, they got 46 preaching stations in that one country. And a full social ministry program.
tables full of printed material, Sunday school and all kinds of devotional material and so forth in the Portuguese language, far more than there is in Spanish, although the Spanish are three-fourths of Latin America is Spanish, not Portuguese. And really some fantastic work has been done. So I'm very happy about the overall state of the Missouri Synod today. It ain't perfect. There are some of you that probably say, yeah, but there is some guy out there that had a Methodist sponsor, and I have to say, yes, there probably is. And there's somebody out there that conducted an illicit, illegal, immoral, un-Lutheran, sub-Christian service with a Catholic priest at some point. I agree. It's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was. And things are going in the right direction. And frankly, the church is looking to you young men. I get out talking to these preachers and these officials who say, oh, we've still got all these characters. They're all doing this. They don't give any money. They don't make calls. They don't do a thing except sit around and gripe and grouse and go to ecumenical meetings. And that's not far off. I think there are some guys who do absolutely nothing else but that. Thank the Lord they're not numerous. But I'm hearing from coast to coast, district after district of every kind and description, compliments for the graduates of the seminaries that are coming out. And I think that to a very great extent, the future of the church is in this room. And I think the future of this church is going to be brighter than its past. And I think the Missouri Synod is going to be a stronger, a more confessional, a more loving, caring, mission-minded church, and one that is really going to do some good in the Lord's kingdom. Okay, Mr. President, I went longer than I thought I would, but I get carried away with all of this stuff. So you guys fire away on questions.
You want to field your own?
I can field them. If you got a sour look on your face, I just can never see you somehow.
I know you're kind of unaccustomed to speaking
that.
In public.
Yeah, okay.
Fire away. Bill Engfer would like it if you'd use the mic, but...
why don't you walk right back to that mic?
Don't feel limited by that.
Yes, I was quite disturbed to see President Fink of the Atlantic District publicly worshiping with Roman Catholics who still officially, you know, curse the central doctrine of Scripture. Now, I was wondering, you know, is there any way, can you assure us that in the future such abuses, you know, can be curbed, especially by our district presidents, you know, who should set a better example for Orthodox Lutheranism?
I had talked to President Fink and asked him not to do it. I also wrote him. I hope that he will heed my brotherly and non-publicized admonitions on it. One of the problems you run into is that, and I'm not defending it, but some of these so-called participations may not really be a violation of principle. Sometimes they are. And I have to say that in a few cases, they are somewhat ambiguous in that the Synod has really perhaps never answered the question, such as, I think in his case, can a Missouri Synod man, say, read a scripture lesson at such and such a meeting? What I tried to make clear, and I did it in a, not only with reference to Fink, but with all of them. In the first place, this whole thing has a kind of a phony baloney tinge to it. The church presidents were approached by a consortium made up of Dickie Newhouse, of the triple membership that I mentioned a while ago, the editor of Lutheran Forum, a man who has absolutely no standing of any kind or description in the Missouri Senate, except he's got a typewriter. And he runs a newspaper. He and a Catholic priest, whom I had never heard of in my life, approached the church presidents and asked them to get with it and sponsor, together with the Roman Catholic bishops, a whole nationwide celebration of the Augsburg Confession. I simply wrote back and said, no, thank you. But being a politician, as I was describing a while ago, he makes an end run and then hits the district presidents. I think maybe something of the same kind was done with the Catholic bishops. It's my general observation that the Catholic bishops of the United States, and I think they're about 1,000 in number, do not have any particular head. I don't think there's anybody who can say to all American bishops, now, do it this way. I don't think they've got the control over, say, the American bishops that the Missouri Synod allegedly has over its 38 DPs. The only one that directs them is the Pope, but there is no American head. There's no Spanish head or Irish head or whatever, as far as I can see. Therefore, the average American bishop does pretty much as he pleases, unless given very specific orders from Rome. And as I see our friend over there, I gather that he's got a lot of things on his mind. At least if I had his job, I'd say, boy, I got quite a long agenda here, you know. So they kind of got mixed into it, and you will find Roman bishops doing all kinds of different things, ranging from some places where they will say, oh, I wouldn't anymore take part in a service with a Lutheran and I'd fly, to fellas who, for any number of reasons, may say, well, of course, be delighted to do it. I was very pleased. Well, when this thing came out then and they made an end run and went to our DPs, I brought it to our council of presidents, discussed it with them. Later on, wrote a nasty letter. I do that about once in a lifetime. To Newhouse and to several other people, which I then copied and sent to every one of our DPs, which kind of set the tone, or what I felt was the position of the Missouri Synod on this subject. I think that the overwhelming majority pretty well complied with it. The only one that really got kind of out of the hopper on it was Fink, and I'm not even, he made every effort to be very candid with me and explain to me what he was doing, and was very anxious to justify what he considered to be a very minimal part. Part of Fink's problem is that a guy like Otten, that's what I mentioned a while ago about the taking in too much territory, Otten makes no distinction between a small sin and a huge sin. Everything, all sins, his motto is, my enemies can do no right and my friends can do no wrong. And if it's very hard, if you go by Christian News, or for that matter, MIP or Lutheran Forum, you really, to determine what the facts are as over against what the report is sometimes a major occupation. You're getting it in Christian News now on a couple of discipline cases over in Indiana. Any similarity between the report in Christian News and the facts is purely coincidental. I'm not saying this to put him down. I'm just saying that it's hard to get all of the dope on this. There are two or three presidents who could have been, who got caught in this, but none of them are getting the publicity except Fink. And I did not condone it, but I am not ready, you know, to read them out of the church. I've admonished, and I continue to do that, and I think quite successfully with most of them. Others? Yes, sir.
Yes.
Loud.
To know why the canonical subsidies to seminaries has been decreasing
I'd like to know it too, because it has not. It has been increasing. I'll tell you this, if you ever become a school president, what you want to do is ask for $1 million more than you have any reason to expect. And then you can spend the rest of the year bellyaching and saying, they gave us $1 million less than we asked for. The real bottom line figure is, what did they give you as compared to what they gave you last year? Now, I don't believe it has been decreased, has it?
It's stayed relatively constant.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. Next question.
The percentage has the percentage has of total budget has decreased.
Well,
the,
and
the actual subsidy has gone up about 1 or 2% each
I'm not going to tell you guys how to vote on the 4th of November, but when you're living in a nation with a 14% inflation, I mean, we can play this arithmetic game forever, and you read it. We do it. I can say to you here, the number of dollars is increasing every year. Praise God. That's one fact. The other fact is the purchasing power of those dollars is decreasing every year. That's another fact. And you guys come from farms. Your dad grows corn. Sure, he gets more money for the corn. That's good. Government put out, farmers made more money than they ever did before in their history. The other side of the coin, they paid more for the machinery, more for the seed, more for the fertilizer, more for the gas, tra-la, tra-la, and every farmer is on the way to the poorhouse. It's a, you know, it's always a relative matter. So there have been a few more dollars. The increases have been slight. But the total purchasing power has certainly been decreased. Not picking out the seminaries, everybody suffered pretty much the same thing. Anyone else? Back there, loud. I think any of you that I know it, when I was in Springfield in the old days, we had a saying, I got to read Time magazine so I know what to think this week. If you read Time, Newsweek, U.S. News, any of them, they're all filled with articles on the alliance between the evangelicals and particularly the Reagan forces. It's very interesting, and I've been involved in some of it by virtue of my office. I perhaps read those articles a little differently from the way you do, or I mean the average guy, because while there's all this yak-yak, pictures of these fellas on the cover, what's this guy's name, the fellow in Virginia? That type of thing. Shows you how much I know about things. I go home to my wife and I say, "You look familiar. What is your name again?" The pictures are always these fellas that are part of the electric church. I don't recall reading in the name in those articles, and I read a long one from the New York Times, and I read, I think it was Newsweek or something. I don't recall seeing the name of a single denomination. We're developing in this country a political force made up of the electronic church with those millions of dollars they get, and then partly the press, certain journals. I don't want to name any of them because I haven't read them with enough detail to to be able to say it's this journal or that journal, but I get that feeling. You have quite a strong movement. For example, I went to Kansas City some years ago to a meeting on futurism, which I thought was very worthwhile and very worth going to, sponsored, I believe, by the Billy Graham Foundation. A great many of the people there, a surprising number of them, were people who were associated with freelance seminaries, the Electric Church, editors of periodicals, not very many of what we would call the denominational type. In fact, the so-called denominational type is so out of it that several years ago I was invited to a meeting, very secret. There was no publicity given to it, and that was all stated in the invitation, of church body presidents. And somebody said, wouldn't it be nice if we, who have a great deal in common in the whole area of church administration, looking at the future, the finances, and all the things that, whether I'm the president of the Missouri Senate or talking to the president of the Southern Baptist Convention, we have a great number of things of that kind in common. But that's a very loose-hanging thing. I've attended, I think, two meetings, been invited to about eight, and the number never gets more than 30 or 40 out of some 200 denominations in this country. It is no political force at all. We had Al Rognes from Luther Seminary in to give us a Bible study. That's about the height of political activity. But these other kind of freelancers who really don't answer to anybody are the people that are in the forefront on this. I was invited to a meeting, I won't tell you the names, but I was invited to a meeting that was announced as secret, which had as its purpose to promote the Reagan campaign on the part of evangelicals. In other words, what you're reading in the press in August of 1980 was being cooked up in about June of 1979. And as an inducement, for example, they sent me a statement by Reagan expressing his faith. Out of that came the discussion that's gone on regarding the born-again business. I'd bet my bottom buck that a similar meeting was called prior to the Carter campaign of certain people. I was not invited to that one because I think they probably feel that the Missouri Synod is an overwhelmingly Republican organization. But at any rate, I was invited to this and importuned by a member of the Missouri Synod to go to it. It just happened that I was going out to visit spend a weekend with one of our board of directors members, who's a lawyer. I took this stuff along, and by the way, a very ardent Republican, as are all members of the Missouri Synod Board of Directors. And most of them think that Reagan's a little too liberal. But anyway, I showed him this stuff. I said, what would you advise? He said, I wouldn't go near it. He said, that thing opens up and you could have the whole Senate involved in a lobbying operation and we'd all be thrown into the jaws of the Internal Revenue Department and made a taxed organization. So I stayed out. And I don't think you see denominational heads in it. I think the problem is that if we've lived, the oldest man in this room, and I may be that man, I don't know, but whoever is the oldest man in this room has lived his whole life watching the National Council of Churches, the old Federal Council of Churches, play politics in Washington, and the Catholic Church, Catholic bishops, all play politics in Washington. This thing with the abortion business, I think a great deal. I was invited once to attend a meeting of Roman Catholics, some of these same evangelicals, and a few other odds and ends, trying to bring peace among these warring factions who had one thing in common. They were all were opposed to abortion, but everybody was grandstanding. Everybody wanted to be up front, and they said there's only one man in the United States that can get these people into a room and get them to talk together, and that was yours truly. And I did. I sat at the head of the table with the chairman of the Catholic bishops, and we sort of said, now, folks, will you kindly shut up and let's try to work together instead of eating each other out all the time. Total distrust, all this kind of thing. But what's new about it, I mean, this business of churches in politics is old stuff. But it usually was the liberals, the left-wingers. Now you've gotten the conservatives into the act. I think they're doing exactly the same kind of thing. I think for a church body, a denomination, to get into this is very risky. Very risky. I bet I could talk to any church president I know and he'd say exactly the same thing. I was very unhappy with Bergstrom of the Lutheran Council coming with his expose of the Washington for Jesus, which grew out of this thing I just mentioned. Not because what he said was untrue, but because what he said was biased. He made it appear as if the people supporting Reagan were doing something that had never been done before, which was a lot of baloney. It has always been done. It had been done with finesse by the left-wing church groups. And if he'd wanted to be unbiased, he would have had another expose on their activity. But anyway, I myself kind of steer clear of it. On the other hand, you as future preachers, I think you got a role to play in a community. It may be very important in your community, ranging from things like garbage pickup to education to crime on the streets or whatever it may be, that I don't think you can just sit back and say, well, I'm a Lutheran minister and I don't care if the garbage piles up 40 feet high in front of the homes of my parishioners and the rats start biting their kids. That becomes a problem that you got to deal with, or that the town is run by the crime syndicate. I don't say that this should not be your involvement. I think the Missouri Senate, for example, and even the Wisconsin Senate, which is far less politically inclined than we are, have passed resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment on abortion because we feel it's a moral issue. I don't think we should fool around with the election of a candidate. I think it would be, I would not become, would not make a speech for a particular political candidate, not in my office. But I think we got a right to take positions on issues that have a genuine religious significance. On the other hand, I fight this constantly. I'm asked to sign statements on disarmament. I was very unhappy and expressed my unhappiness with a statement prepared by LaCusa regarding the draft, as did our representative on the committee that drafted that thing, Charlie Miller. He and I were both very unhappy because it was so totally biased. I think, for example, you guys are going to have to counsel young men who come to you maybe at night and say, Pastor, I don't really know if I can sign up for the draft. To him, it may be a moral issue, and I don't think you can deny his constitutional rights, but I don't think you need to get up and preach a sermon on the art and joy of draft evasion. That's something else, because that's also a part of his patriotic duty and his Christian service to his country. It's a fine line, and you grow in wisdom on this. But I am nervous about the involvement of a denomination, particularly in the election of a candidate when the issues are so complicated as they are. Further.
Could you share with us any personal reflection you had on who you would like to see as your successor?
Oh. I said to the Senate in that letter that I was not going to get involved in the political process favoring anybody. I may have some caveats to the Senate on certain things that I think they must be very careful to avoid. For example, I made the statement already, and I may say it more fully, that we cannot fool around with a man who doesn't know where he's standing doctrinally. We can't fool around with nincompoops, although there's always that possibility. The job requires some brains, and it requires some talent, and it requires some abilities in many, many different areas. But as to coming out and saying, I'm in favor of Joe Blow, no, I wouldn't do that. I think the Senate is going to show pretty good sense. Give them a lot of information. Give them time. Things move, as I say, the glacier. We really should have, as a symbol of our church, a cross and back of it an iceberg or something, because we move that way. And they move very slowly from the to get things to the grassroots. For example, the Manitoba, Saskatchewan district of this Senate, are any of you members of that district? I'd like to congratulate you. Are you? Well, you know, they have 15 subscriptions of the Lutheran Witness in the entire Manitoba, Saskatchewan district. Now, things move slow up there. Pretty close to the North Pole. Yeah. So, I mean, it takes time, but I think they'll come out pretty well. Yeah.
Oh, your representative Blaise, I was wondering, is there anything that we can do as a church body to speed up the publication of our new thing?
You're all right. Take that man's name down. Make a good candidate for the faculty. We're lighting fires all the time. Every part of it is slow. And then to add to it, as if the devil was working on a 24-hour shift, the guy that prepares the plate, the music plates, you know, with the treble and the bass and all that, he went out of business. So, I don't. They say 1981, and I'm a man of faith. I would say to you fellas, don't go out and take on the Lutheran Book of the Lutheran Book of Worship? Don't do that. Keep the seven together as much as you can. I disagree with these people who say, well, I'm going to put this in because everybody moving into my territory is from the LCA, therefore they'll be welcome when they come to our church. The obverse side of the coin is that everybody that transfers out from a Missouri Synod and finds this thing may very well not join you. He may just as well join the LCA down the street, because that's the same hymn book that we're using. So I think the fellow that does it on pragmatic grounds and says, I'm going to gain by this, may end up losing more than he gains on it. I don't know how long you want to go, Dr. Bowman. Question back here? I'll tell you the facts. After the city of Clayton gave us that hospitable treatment, the board at first thought maybe they could sue their way into it, but we felt, what in the world's the use of this? They can just stall and harass forever and spend more money, and the escalating inflation costs, figured it wasn't worth it. Besides that, a lot of us weren't very interested in getting any closer to the seminary anyhow. They've always run the church, and if we put them out here, put the building out here, then everybody would know they ran the church. True? Right? So...
Another thought on that. They've always been in the woods, you might say.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Let's move on to another subject. At the last board of directors meeting, upon recommendation of the committee, we have now four sites. Three of them are bare land, two out near the airport, quite close to one another, one downtown, and then the fourth is a property that has been is presently occupied by the Missouri Pacific Railroad out on the junction of Clayton Road and Highway 44. Highway 40.
It's in Ladue.
You sure it's 40?
Yeah.
All right. He's always right, and I'm always wrong. It's a pretty nice property. It would be quite adequate. The price of buying it and doing some remodeling would probably save us a considerable amount of money. Again, it is location. There are many, many reasons why it's very good to have it downtown. Transportation, hotels, meals, etc. More and more we're moving into putting them into the what's the name of that lovely place, the old Statler down there. We get it for $9.39 a night, double. And I can tell you, it's overpriced. But the Harbor Light Mission, that they supply a bowl of soup with each meal, or with each room. Anyway, three beer cans under the bed. It looks as if the committee is favoring the Missouri Pacific because of the less cost. It has not been finalized. Back there.
In regards to the ALC Fellowship, what is your personal opinion on what should be done in convention? Should we make a final decision on whether or not to have it, or should we continue our so-called...
Well, I think that something is going to have to give on that. I'm not in a position yet, and I don't want to speak for the committee or the CTCR and then have everybody say, well, he called a tune and all we do is jump. They like to do their own decision making. But I think that we're going to have to shift to some degree, because both honesty and credibility simply make it impossible to say that we can't say we've been making progress with them. We haven't. We're arguing the same things we did 11 years ago and a few additional ones. And we're working on some way of trying to say that fellowship as we have understood it and something that implies and means agreement in doctrine simply does not exist, can't be said to exist. And yet, on the other hand, with respect to the local pastor on the local scene, there has to be some way of his being able to operate in a pastoral way and not simply tear up hundreds of congregations over the matter. I can't really say more beyond that. That's about where we're at the moment.
How much time do we have?
Well, I can go on, I guess, for a while. There's another...
I think perhaps in about 5 minutes, though, out of respect for your time and schedule and the fact that they've begun to serve meals, we should probably move to a conclusion. Somebody with some burning questions, why don't you fire them quickly and we'll get a few quick answers and then we'll call it a day. You want to ask another one? Yes.
Would you comment on the role of the charismatic
30 seconds, he says. I don't know. It's regional in a sense. I was just up in Michigan, and that seems to be the hotbed of the whole charismatic movement in the nation. That's all they talked about in Michigan, about the Kansas. Never heard of it. I think the Synod, the district presidents and the officialdom are handling it better in the sense that we're not undergoing as many split congregations and all this kind of thing as we did. It certainly is, in my opinion, still a problem. I do not consider it to be an acceptable institutional Lutheran methodology. I think it very much endangers the doctrine of the authority of Scripture and, to some degree, the doctrine of the sacraments. I don't know that it should be handled in the way, for example, that we handled the doctrinal problems that were centered largely here at Concordia Seminary. Seems to me that the people who get involved in it, by and large, are not mean or crusaders or people who are trying to overturn the thing. I've often felt that the reason the movement kind of caught on in some of these mainline denominations, like the Catholic and the Anglican, has been the fact that we've suffered from a considerable amount of formalism and maybe in some cases some dead orthodoxy. Maybe saying to us that we ought to give a little more life into some of our church activities. For example, I was very pleased at Fort Collins this summer with those 5,000 kids who were really having a good time. I think those young people were very much benefited by that convention, and yet I did not hear of one single injection of charismatic activities. Maybe some of you did, but I didn't hear a thing. And yet I think to give people a chance to express their feelings and to rejoice in their faith and to have some way of expressing it beyond page 5, which, of course, is the most perfect way of expressing it. I think we maybe could learn something from that. I would like to think that the charismatic problem is primarily a pastoral problem rather than a doctrinal one, granted that there are doctrinal problems related to it, and granted that there are some people who ought to be dealt with doctrinally, but I'm not saying that everybody ought to be handled that way. Well, here's one right here.
Say, after you were going to retirement, would you be willing to consider a call at one of our seminaries?
Well, I know that the first thing I'm going to do is take a nice long rest.
What
about
the second
phase? Well, it depends on how long the first phase stays on. I'm not really job hunting. I certainly want to serve the Synod. I don't have any job in my pocket. I'm not doing anything to go to work for anybody else. But I think I'd be willing to serve in a capacity of that kind, as long as I didn't have to be an administrator, as long as I didn't have to go to interminable meetings, and was given certain privileges accorded to a tired man.
No teaching, I suppose.
Very, very little.